So I wanted to speak this evening about themes that are very related to our holiday of Thanksgiving. And I want to speak about generosity and gratitude. And my hope is that I want that you'll be encouraged in the next week to practice one or both of those. So I'll be, in the course of the talk, naming practices for each that are very ordinary, very everyday. And my hope is that you'll be wanting to do practices related to generosity or gratitude in the next week. And again, in relationship to the holiday of Thanksgiving, which in many ways is many of us may see Thanksgiving somewhat ambivalently, right? That its relationship to Native Americans has been seen as problematic for some time. The history, of course, is that we may have got in school is all wrong. None of it happened. The pilgrims didn't call themselves pilgrims, you know, and all sorts of things are off from the conventional story. And of course, Native Americans see it as connected with the genocidal attempts of settlers and government and so forth. The Native American writer Sherman Alexie commented, "Should have had a stricter immigration policy." So, but nonetheless, there are many ways in which Thanksgiving can be quite a wonderful holiday, particularly in its relatively non-commercial nature, even though the commercial aspect is intruding more and more. I read a story where now they have Black Friday sales starting at 4 p.m. on Thanksgiving, right? So that's a continual intrusion. One of the people whom I studied in graduate school was a critical social theorist named Jürgen Habermas, and he had a phrase called the colonization of the life world, which I think is an example of that. Essentially, all the areas which formerly had been off limits to capitalism and bringing in the economic system, places like hospitals, schools, formerly off limits, Thanksgiving, are no longer off limits. Right? So this is a long-standing trend. But nonetheless, there can be some wonderful things about the holiday, and they can be really centered on these qualities of generosity and gratitude. And it's very interesting to look at these qualities in terms of our practice, because these are qualities which directly work against our conditioning. They work against, in particular, our greed, hatred, and delusion in very direct ways, even though they're not mainly meditative practices. They're essentially in the area and the breakdown of the three areas of practice classically into wisdom practices, we might say meditative practices, and ethical practices, or we might say interactive relational practices. They fall in the last category, and they can be very wonderful at getting at our conditioning, our limitations, by developing these qualities. In fact, the Buddha understood generosity in particular as one of the paramis, one of the 10 qualities that he once said, when developed, bring one to become a Buddha. So I will keep speaking. I'll keep on reading my notes. And the recorder is working on batteries, so we are okay. For anyone listening to the recording, there has just been a power failure. Okay. So the Buddha understood the development, in particular, of generosity, dana, as a foundational quality that, when mature, leads one to Buddhahood and is the expression of a fully awakened being. And so that's very powerful. And so we can actually see some of the different dimensions of generosity or dana as going way beyond what we hear when we hear dana talks at retreats, which is primarily focusing on the material aspect of giving. But as we'll see, it's far more extensive and powerful than that. So I want to talk about generosity some, talk about the way we can practice generosity, then talk about gratitude and the way that we can practice gratitude. Yeah. Are you with me, even in the dark? Okay, very good. What? Let's see how I do so far. I mean, my notes are very legible. This joke, not really. Let's see. So, interesting story about generosity. I heard this from Greg Scharf, that he asked his 97-year-old teacher, what is dana? And this 97-year-old teacher had been given some fruit as dana to him, and he, his teacher, took the oranges and started throwing them at Greg as his answer to the question, what is dana? I'm not going to try to interpret that. That's a Zen-like story. Okay. Now, one of the interesting things about generosity and gratitude is that they're very closely related. In fact, there is a sign right in the back of the room. If you can see on the bulletin board, that black sign. And it basically says, we give out of gratitude. And there's this very close connection. The Zen teacher, Steve Stuckey, he once said that that generosity is primarily what we do when we actually are in touch with the gratitude that we know because we have been given so much. That we have gratitude for what we have been given, and in exchange, we offer to others. There's a very similar passage from the Buddha where he says, these two kinds of beings are rare. First, the one who kindly offers, and second, the one who is grateful for what has been received. These two are not easily found. So there's a connection between generosity and gratitude. And I was also thinking about this in relationship to a restaurant that exists in Berkeley. Some of you may have been to it, called Karma Kitchen. And do you know the economic model for Karma Kitchen? It's based on generosity and gratitude, and it's really pointing to what we might call a gift economy. So the Karma Kitchen gives out meals freely as people come in, and there's no bill. And people are told that your meal is only being given to you because someone else paid for it before you came in. And if you wish, you may want to pay for the meals of those coming later. And they've been successful since it was founded about 10 years ago on that model. That there's something, and you know, I had a passage I was going to read from about the restaurant, which I remember, but it's basically saying that gratitude is this expression about connection, about being connected, and that it, you know, when it's the basis of an economic system, there's much more of a sense of interconnection as opposed to what they call soulless, anonymous transactions. Mm-hmm. And so there's that very interesting relationship. The German sociologist Georg Simmel said that gratitude is the moral memory of humanity. I think he was referring to that sense of interconnection. And so these are actually very deep qualities. Generosity in the traditional religions is understood as a very central capacity that's related to the deepest qualities of being a human being. So, for example, in Judaism, the word for generosity is tzedakah, and it's related to words meaning justice and righteousness. In Christianity, the term that gives us our word charity is charitas. But in actuality, it actually most originally means unconditional love. So the word which comes to mean generosity is very linked with a sense of love and giving. Charitas is a translation of the Greek word agape, which many of you know is the deepest dimension of love. And this is where, again, this is where our word, the word that becomes translated as generosity comes from. And even the Latin word generosity is connected with words meaning begetting, being generative. Related to words like generative, it's related to words like genius. There's something very crucial about it. In Islam, generosity is one of the five pillars of practice that one is commended to engage in every day. And then we have, in indigenous traditions, we do have, in many cases, something like the gift economy, where there's this pervasive sense of giving. We also have that sense in many parts, even of the U.S., but many parts of the world which are not so integrated into the mainstream economy. And I can remember spending a lot of time in the mountains of Virginia, where people more or less were living as if it was the 19th century, as farmers, and there was a tremendous sense of giving and offering. My brother and I once intended to build a house. And we built virtually the whole house, except for the roof, based on what people gave us. People gave us the wood of old sheds. They gave us wood that was around. They gave us all sorts of things. They helped in so many ways. And there was that sense of a tremendous sense of freely giving, which was part of the culture. Everyone helped with everyone else's harvest, right? And that is, you know, that is there at times, I think, in the culture, particularly when there is need or crisis. You know, maybe we've seen that sense of generosity be there when there's a health crisis and people just want to help. Or maybe some of you know people who have received so much after the fires in the Santa Rosa and other areas. And so there can be that sense of generosity, I think, as a very natural quality. And yet it gets covered over, doesn't it, by conditioning. I think we also see that young children are very generous. And it gets, when does that end? What age? When does that natural generosity end for children? In the Buddhist tradition, You know, the word again that we use is dana. And it's generosity has multiple meanings. It's really seen as a kind of a treasure. It's seen as a gift from the electricity gods. For anyone listening to the recording who is not present, the lights have just gone back, and I am still looking at my notes from page one, even though I'm way beyond page one. So in Buddhist tradition, again, dana is very central. It's said that the Buddha, when he would be giving his series of teachings, would always start with generosity. Generosity was always where the Buddha began. Again, even though it's not a deep meditative practice, in some way, maybe contemplating generosity could be, but generosity is just a very everyday practice. And we'll see when we talk about practices, it's very, can be very everyday and very ordinary. Here's a passage from the Buddha. Giving is threefold by way of the object to be given: the giving of material things, the giving of fearlessness, and the giving of the Dhamma. So there are a variety of objects that one gives. We often think, again, we often think of dana or generosity as this add-on, as something like maybe giving a tip or something. It's something that we do which is not deeply significant. I'm generalizing, this isn't true for everyone, of course. But it's often that we just think of dana as, you know, even at a talk or at a retreat, as just a little bit like a tip. My mother did not like the dana system. She said, people think of it just like a tip. And you should just get paid a lot. That's what she said. And we can take dana in this limited way. In the tradition, it's not that way. And it really points to this very heartfelt and central quality. So we can give material objects. Interestingly, you saw the second object given was fearlessness. It really points to the way that another aspect of giving is that we give our being. We give what is valuable in our own being. We give our awakened qualities. We give our friendliness. We give our kindness and so forth. And this is really important to see as an aspect. And the fearlessness that we offer may be the example of our own fearlessness, or it may be more that we make ourselves not to be feared by others. I think we can interpret that passage in a few ways, you know. And so I think that's a beautiful way to see that we are actually offering our lives. You know, Walt Whitman had a line in Song of Myself which goes something like that. He said, when I give, I do, and I'm paraphrasing, when I give, I do not just give things, I give myself. You know, and presumably he thought that was a good thing. And then there's this last aspect of giving, which is the Dhamma, which again is actually taken to be the highest of gifts, is to give the gift of the teachings and practices that bring one to freedom. This is the highest gift. You know, and I remember it was in one of the passages it said that one can actually never repay one's parents for what they gave us, but the closest we can come is to help them with their opening to the Dhamma, or the Dharma, the teachings and practices of liberation. In the Mahayana tradition, the perfection of giving is understood as pointing to a way of giving in which there's no sense of self, no sense of the object, and no sense of the recipient. but rather you can get a sense. It's more the natural flow of one's being without added on thoughts. Right? And I imagine, you know, when we look to our own generosity, we'll actually find it is like that sometimes. You know, when we do, and I'll get in a moment to the generosity practices, but when we actually focus some on generosity for a week, one of the fruits of that is we'll notice all the ways that we're generous that we weren't even tracking. And we'll notice that a lot of it just happens very spontaneously out of the goodness of our being. And that's actually very good to know more about. I don't think we track that so carefully, and yet if we do look, it's there. It's there more. And so again, the reason for these practices is to cut through our conditioning. Generosity particularly cuts through greed. It cuts through that hanging on to objects, the grasping, the wanting, the sense of accumulating my own pile of stuff, of things, of money. And it can really work through those tendencies. When we take on the intention of generosity, we at times will come up against our own grasping. And we can look at it and see it as part of the practice. In a similar way, I think gratitude can cut through a sense of aversion. And I'll get to that in a moment. In the outline of how to practice generosity traditionally, part of what one notices when one practices is all the ways that one falls short of being fully generous. You know, the way that our motivation is sort of mixed, that we give in order to get something in return, or we give to look good, or we give to have a reputation, or we give to avoid something else happening. And there are texts where all the imperfect ways of giving are outlined. One gives because it is considered good, and so forth, to get a good reputation, to get favoritism, and so forth. So how to practice generosity? So I hope that some of us are inspired to do this for the next week. And I've been working on generosity myself for about the last 2 weeks. Been interested in developing it. And I'll mention the practices that I do. I've been taking every time that I drive as a starting point for generosity. This is not necessarily a beginning practice. So you may want to do something more modest, but it's very interesting, you know. And I'm glad I've been doing it because I've been taking generosity while driving as a practice. And to be honest, until a few weeks ago, I think I slacked off the practice. I was noticing that because I was honking more. And so, generosity practice when driving, what would it mean? It would mean maybe saying, oh yes, you're clearly in a hurry, going to probably a medical appointment. Please cut right in front of me. So this may appeal to you, it may not. So another form of generosity practice that I've been doing is trying to do several acts of generosity a day. And this is a wonderful practice. Take on doing one act a day, or three acts a day, or five acts a day. I was taking on five acts, and I found it really helpful as a practice, partly because, in a way, I was looking to get to that number five. And so, I would be just going about my business during the day, and suddenly something would occur, and I'd say, oh, opportunity for generosity. You know, maybe it'd be someone would need something or ask for something, or, you know, there'd be some request from a friend. And there's no shortage of requests via junk mail and the internet and emails from me. I get 20 or 30 requests a day. Do you get that? Yes. Yeah, I mean, anyway, so that's, again, how to sort through that. But one can do the practice and really say, what's calling me? What's really there for me? And again, it really helps to track. When I've been doing this practice, it's really been helpful because I've noticed all the times when I am generous that I wouldn't have noticed otherwise. I think that's really, really crucial. So you can do that. You can take on doing one or three or five acts of generosity a day. You know, and if it gets towards the evening and you're at number three, then you got to scramble. See what you're going to do. You know, another way is to choose some activity and really develop generosity in that activity. And again, for some of us, this may be our work. Some of us, how many of us are in the helping professions? And so a lot of people, so this may be something that you actually track, that you're actually being generous a lot. And you still may take on that practice of cultivating generosity. Maybe it helps you go a little further. You know, so that's, you could cultivate that practice in your work, in a particular helping relationship, in some given activity that you're following. And just to take that on, to take on that kind of practice. Another way might be to, I don't know, one thing that I've sometimes done is always have food with me and give the food to people in need. You could also take on as a practice bringing a certain amount of money and giving it away. And, you know, some of you may have heard of this study where researchers gave people $50 and in the control group they had them spend it on themselves. And in the other group they had people give the money to others. And then they had a measure to test after the giving had occurred, either the giving to others or the buying of something for oneself, they had a measure to test relative level of happiness. And they found that the people who gave to others were much happier. That's very interesting. And so there, and we'll see, there's very similar research with gratitude. From the Buddha, what is the treasure of generosity, of dana? There is the case of a disciple of the noble ones, that person's awareness cleansed of the stain of stinginess, living at home, freely generous, open-hearted, open-handed, delighting in being magnanimous, responsive to requests, delighting in the distribution of alms. This is called the treasure of generosity. Okay, so it's way more than that simple, occasional giving of material items. Again, gratitude is very, very much related. There's a poem from Rebecca Del Rio about gratitude. Gratitude means showing up on life's doorstep, love's threshold, dressed in a clown suit, rubber-nosed, gunboat shoes flapping. Gratitude shows up with arms full of wildflowers, reciting McEwen or the worst of Neruda. To talk of gratitude is to be the fool in a cynic's world. Gratitude is pride's nightmare, the admission of humility before something given without expectation or attachment. Gratitude tears open the shirt of self-importance, scatters buttons across the polished floors of feigned indifference, ignores the obvious and laughs out loud. Even more, gratitude bares her breast, rips open her ribs to show the naked heart, the holy heart. What if that sacred heart is not, after all, about sacrifice? Imagine it is about joy, barefoot and foolhardy, something unasked for, something unearned. What if the best we the beat we hear when we are finally quiet is simply this: thank you, thank you, thank you. So there's that quality of gratitude, again, coming often out of a sense of acknowledgement that one has received a lot, that others have been generous to oneself, this close relationship of generosity and gratitude. There's a... Again, one of the main themes in Native traditions is the offering of thanks. In fact, the offering of thanks is an offering in so many religious traditions. You know, I was just recently at the Abbey of Gethsemane in Kentucky, where essentially they have seven offices a day where they chant, and these are all offerings of praise, offering of thanks. That's how they see it. And Thomas Merton once said, "My spiritual practice is at its essence the offering of thanks and praise." And in Native tradition, there is this continual sense of gratitude. This is from a Thanksgiving address from the Iroquois. "With one mind, we turn to honor and thank all the food plants we harvest from the garden. Since the beginning of time, the grains, vegetables, beans, and berries have helped the people survive. Many other living things draw strength from the two. We gather all the plant foods together as one and send them a greeting of thanks." There's that very strong sense in the tradition. So we can be grateful for so many things in our lives. And one of the ways, main ways that we practice gratitude is that we can actually reflect on and write down a number of aspects that we're grateful for, a number of parts of our lives that we're grateful for. We can write them down on a sheet. One gratitude practice, which I did for about 2 years, was to write down what I'm grateful for, have about 10 things, and then look at them every morning and reflect on them for 10 minutes. And the gratitude, that's a simple gratitude practice. And you can do that. Another way to do gratitude practice is to simply in the moment see what you're grateful for and hang out there for a few minutes. I do that 4 times a day. I remember what I'm grateful for just in the moment. It can be something more, you know, with the first gratitude practice, we really have that sense of being grateful for some of the bigger things in our lives. We can also be grateful just for the smaller things. I'm really grateful I connected with this person. I'm grateful that I slept well. I'm grateful for this meal. And what gratitude does is it really can cut through any habitual tendencies to aversion. You know, I know for myself, having grown up, tending to focus on problems, gratitude practice is wonderful. It really goes against a lot of the conditioning. So I was raised to be a very good analytical problem solver. I go into a situation, I immediately see the problems, and I know what to do. More or less. And gratitude practice goes against that. Much like mudita practice, a joy practice, we develop the tendency to gravitate towards the positive. And for many of us, that really directly goes against our conditioning. Anyone have that conditioning to focus on the negative? So-called negativity bias, which is a major feature of most people's brains, right? Okay, let me go right to what's negative. And gratitude practice counters that, as does mudita practice. Sometimes we think of reflecting on where there's joy in our own life as one of the forms of mudita practice, which is joy in what's beautiful or positive. So we can practice in that way. I was reflecting that I remember I once was teaching at Spirit Rock, and I stayed all day, as I often do, and I left Spirit Rock about 8:30, thinking that I'd be home in Berkeley in about 40 minutes. And when I got to the entrance towards the Richmond Bridge, I could tell that it was not going to be so quick. And in fact, there was a long line virtually from the moment that you got on coming off 3rd Street in San Rafael. And I think somehow I heard on the news there had been an accident on the bridge. And in actuality, It took me 4 hours to get back. It was helpful to know that it was going to be a long time. Because I, just for that 4 hours, I did equanimity practice and I did gratitude practice. And it really made for a wonderful period of slowly moving in my car. Right? And so one could take, actually, as another form of gratitude practice, try gratitude practice when something happens that's not so good. That's advanced practice, right? It's a very interesting kind of practice. You know, so again, we could do gratitude practice as a simple 10-minute practice during the day. We could practice it spontaneously at certain times, just reflecting what we're grateful for. This will all counter tendencies to be aversive, conditioned tendencies to be aversive. So you can see that both generosity and gratitude, in a sense, are purifying. They're purifying our being, and they do so in a way which is just as significant as what we do in meditation. You know? In meditation, the principle is that we work with insight, where we see our grasping, where we see our compulsive aversion. But when we take on a practice like generosity or gratitude, we do something very similar. And when we couple generosity and gratitude practice with mindfulness and the cultivation of insight, it may be a very strong practice for many of us. Not an add-on. Not simply something to mention in passing at the end of a retreat. It's actually a very significant practice. And if what I just said was not enough reason to practice gratitude and generosity, here's some more scientific research about gratitude. There's a doctor named Doraswamy who is at Duke University Medical Center. He said, if gratitude were a drug, it would be the world's best-selling product with a health maintenance indication for every major organ system. So here it is. The development of gratitude leads to measurable effects on these systems. It affects positively the mood transmitters, that is serotonin and norepinephrine. It affects the reproductive hormones, the social bonding hormones, oxytocin, cognitive and pleasure-related neurotransmitters, dopamine, inflammatory and immune system, stress hormones, cardiac and EEG rhythms, blood pressure, and blood sugar. And they found that these are not people doing 20 hours or 10 hours of gratitude practice every day. These are small periods of gratitude practice. A lot of the tests have been done with people doing gratitude journals where they just write in the journal every day what they're grateful for. You know, and when they've done those tests, that they have found that compared to control groups, people who develop gratitude for a 5-week period, at the end of the 5-week period, were actually taking better care of themselves and tended to have better health and were exercising more than the control group. Interesting, isn't it? Right? Now, one of the more advanced practices of gratitude is to also, in a sense, learn to have gratitude for what's difficult in one's life. You know, that one can see in a way that many of the difficulties that one had, at least potentially, led to learning. Can we see the difficulties of our lives that way? Often not, right? Maybe other people, but not for me. This is an interesting poem from the former Olympic runner, Billy Mills, who was a Native American. He won the marathon was it at the, or maybe no, it was 10,000 meters, I'm sorry. I think the 10,000 meters race at the 1964 Olympics. And you can look on YouTube, and it's a very, when I read this poem, I researched him some. And so he has a kind of a poem, it's actually from one of his books, kind of a prose poem. And I looked him up, and there's a very remarkable YouTube, I guess YouTube video of his win in the Olympics. It was unexpected. I think he was the first U.S. runner ever to win at that distance. And he was also Native American. And so this is what he wrote later in his life. In my youth, I respected the world and life. I needed not anything but peace of heart. And I changed, despite myself, and believed in Iktumi's lies. Probably the force of delusion he believed in. He seemed to know all the truth. He promised to make me happy. He made me ask Wakantanka, is the sense of the Great Spirit, for wealth that I might have power. So that was how, that was his conditioning. That was where the route he was going. So here's what he says. I was given poverty that I might find my inner strength. I asked for fame so others would know me. I was given obscurity that I might know myself. I asked for a person to love that I might never be alone. I was given a life of a hermit that I might learn to accept myself. I asked for power that I might achieve. I was given weakness that I might learn to obey. I asked for health that I might lead a long life. I was given infirmity that I might appreciate each minute. I was given Mother Earth for strength. I asked Mother Earth for strength that I might have my way. I was given weakness that I might feel the need for her. I asked to live happily that I might enjoy life. I was given life that I might live happily. I received nothing I asked for, yet all my wishes came true. Despite myself, in Iktumi, my dreams were fulfilled. I am richly blessed more than I ever hoped for. I thank you, Wakantanka, for what you have given me. That's out of difficulty.
What's his name again?
Billy Mills, B-I-L-L-Y-M-I-L-L-S. We have a sense of how to practice, and even taking difficulties, can one, in a sense, be grateful? Maybe not immediately, but after some time, can I be grateful for past difficulties? From the Sufi poet Hafiz, I had to seek the physician because of the pain this world caused me. I could not believe what happened when I got there. I found my teacher. Before I left, my teacher said, "Up for a little homework? Yeah?" "Okay," I replied. "Well then, try thanking all the people who have caused you pain. They helped you come to me." So that's advanced gratitude practice. Right? But it's, I wanted to mention that just as the horizon. I was thinking just of some other expressions of gratitude. One might is related, which is to express appreciation. You know, I think we have a culture that's sometimes short on appreciation. I know that when I've been in groups or organizations where we've had go-rounds where everyone expressed something that one was appreciative of maybe one's coworker. It was very, very significant. I realized it had almost never happened. And so that could be another way to express gratitude, to in the related way of expressing appreciation. It might just be that you want to express appreciation to someone every day. That would be a form of practice. Okay, so let me finish, then we can have some discussion. This is a poem, another poem by Gary Snyder. It's also about gratitude. It's called Prayer for the Great Family, which he modeled after a Mohawk prayer. Gratitude to Mother Earth sailing through night and sky, night and day, into her rich soil, rare and sweet. In our minds, so be it. Gratitude to plants, the sun facing, light changing, leaf and fine root hairs, standing still through wind and rain. Their dance is in the flowing spiral grain. In our minds, so be it. Gratitude to air, bearing the soaring swift and the silent owl at dawn, breath of our song, clear spirit breeze in our minds, so be it. Gratitude to wild beings, our brothers, teaching secrets, freedoms, and ways, who share with us their milk, self-complete, brave, and aware in our minds, so be it. Gratitude to water, clouds, lakes, rivers, glaciers, holding or releasing, streaming through all our bodies, salty seas in our minds, so be it. Gratitude towards the sun, blinding, pulsing light through trunks of trees, through mists, warming caves where bears and snakes sleep, he who wakes us in our minds, so be it. Gratitude to the great sky who holds billions of stars and yet goes beyond that, beyond all powers and thoughts, and yet is within us. Grandfather space, the mind is his wife, so be it. Just take a moment and see if you're drawn to do a generosity practice in the coming week or a gratitude practice. Now I can see more clearly the poster at the back of the room on the bulletin board, which is was put up in coordination with this talk. It says, out of gratitude we give. So your thoughts, reflections, maybe some of you have generosity or gratitude practices that you'd like to share. Yeah, and we'll use the mic.
In addition to the resources that you need, I don't know whether you're familiar with Nikon, which is the Japanese art of self-reflection, is a short way of putting it. There's a book, N-A-I-K-A-N, and there's a book by Greg Creech, K-R-E-C-H, and he offers an online course of the year, which I did last year, and I'm doing it again. Each day one reflects, amongst other things, on one, what have I received from others?
Yeah.
Two, what have I given to others? And three, what difficulties or troubles have I caused others? And
it's a daily practice, yeah. Yeah. Practice. Why don't you give the resource again?
It's a book, it's called Nikon, N-A-I-K-A-N. And the author is Greg Creech. But it's spelled K-R-E-C-H.
K-R-E-C-H.
And it's he also has his own institute called the Todo Institute, or Todo, I'm not sure. And he offers a number of online courses, but I took it last year and I signed up for it again this year. And it's quite useful, because what you said, the heart of what you said is paying attention.
Yeah.
And this is just another resource for paying attention to gratitude, to grace, to generosity.
Paying attention and then working with intention, you know, to say, okay, this is a way I'm focusing my day, right? And again, that is so much at the center of our practice. It just helps us to remember to take these moments as moments of learning rather than just being on automatic, right? That's the center of our practice, is to find ways as much as possible during the day so we're not on automatic, but we're actually taking this life as a learning and transformation process. It's not easy. We often say, practice isn't hard. Remembering to practice is hard. That's what we always say that. And that's true, isn't it? Once you're in a place, practice isn't so hard, but get off, you just get into our distractions, right? So intention is really crucial. And something like this can really, if you do, I would say, if you're inclined to do it, just do it for 1 week. You don't have to make a commitment to do it for more than a week. And then really make that strong commitment. And something gets done. And then at the end of the week, see if you want to continue it. Please.
I love gratitude practice, and I've also found it a really good way to sort of kickstart metta practice, especially because when I feel gratitude, I feel it in the body, and turning that energy then to a lot of piti and sukha arises, and it just makes metta just so easy.
Makes metta better.
Both metta. Right. Whiskey is good, but metta is better.
Thank you for this talk. I really enjoyed it. About 15 years ago at Spirit Rock, at a day long, or maybe the Friday yoga class, one of the teachers, and I can't remember which one, suggested we pair up with someone else to be a gratitude partner.
Yeah.
And they said exchange an email once a week with that person about what you're grateful for. Well, my gratitude partner happened to not use email. And for 15 years, we've continued that practice where we mail each other something every week. And what I love about it is my radar is out all the time for what I can share about what I'm grateful for. So when I find myself being grateful, so I'm like, oh, I can tell her I'm grateful for that. And I get excited about my gratitude because I can share it. So I love this gratitude practice. And for 15 years, my gratitude buddy and I have still been sharing. And it's so nice to get mail that isn't a bill and isn't this. I get real mail once a week that's just a letter with her expressing her gratitude, and then I return it with my expressing my gratitude. But it keeps the radar.
Wonderful.
It's a wonderful practice.
Yeah, and then one could do that with regular mail, one can do it with email. I think Sylvia Borstein has been doing that for some years herself with a colleague. Where they exchange gratitude emails. I don't know if it's, I think it's more than once a week. Yeah. And so that's a wonderful practice. And again, gratitude can really lighten the mind. So it can be very beneficial at the beginning of a meditation. Yeah.
Yeah, I sort of do that at the beginning of my morning meditation.
Yeah.
But I do the three set of breathing. In the way it's sort of opening to what is, and then with every center, there's one thing I'm grateful for. And even if I wake up in a terrible mood, I can at least go to the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. But lots of times, there's many other things.
Yeah. Yeah. So again, we're hearing some wonderful practices. I like that of doing it near the beginning of a practice, maybe when one wakes up, really. That'd be pretty interesting. Gratitude practice right when you wake up. That'd be interesting, wouldn't it? Please, and then in the back. Yeah.
Is impatience a particular obstacle toward generosity, or is it just one of many?
I think, is patience a central obstacle towards generosity or just one of many?
Impatience.
Impatience, yeah. Yeah. In looking at different passages, I did not see impatience mentioned in that way. Patience is, I think it's more in the Mahayana system, is one of the Mahayana paramis. And so these are the qualities which are sort of mutually supportive. I think that impatience often would be because of some kind of grasping. And maybe that's where you were coming from, that there would often be some kind of grasping, at least to have something happen now. And so it would tend to contract the mind. And generosity would work more with an expansive mind and heart. And so I think impatience would make one a little more contracted. So I think there could be many ways that we get a little more contracted. Yeah, thank you. But it's interesting to look at. Yeah. Yeah, please.
Several years ago, I read an op-ed in the New York Times about generosity, and I don't even remember who the author was, but it was a really good article. They recommended a generosity journal.
Yeah.
Gratitude journal. And I started one, and I found at times it was real difficult sometimes to start thinking about what I was grateful for, because I tended to focus on the big picture stuff.
Yeah.
And but what I did notice is that my feeling of generosity started to really kick in a lot more. And it was then I was very easy to give out. So I've kept it up sort of on and off over the years. And your talk now has encouraged me to get up and start really thinking more about the small.
The small things, yeah, to go back and, it doesn't, it's helpful to tune into the big ones, but like the practice that I do, several times a day, is mostly with the small stuff. And just like seeing what spontaneously I'm grateful for in the moment, and it just sort of sets a tone. And I thought I'd read, I found a passage that I paraphrased when we had darkness from Steve Stuckey. The spirit of giving is based on a feeling of gratitude, of being deeply thankful for the ability to give and to receive, to be freely willing to participate in this reciprocal turning of life energy. Yeah. Anyone else? Anything about generosity or gratitude? Could be a story. Yeah, Mary.
One thing that I've started being really happy about is when traffic is really heavy.
Yeah.
And I'm, it is particularly heavy right now. And when I'm, when people are merging in, and I'm in the right lane and people are merging in. And so what I've started doing is imagining that the people who are trying to merge are my children.
Yeah.
And it just makes, please go ahead. No, go ahead. You're fine. And it makes it fun. It really makes it feel good.
Yeah, driving is it's a phenomenon that the Buddha did not give deep guidance on. And it's certainly we could have a discourse on driving. Of course, people have written. I think Sylvia did something. Sylvia Borstein did something on, I think it was called Road Sage. but it brings up a lot, right? It can bring up a lot. Like, here we are. Maybe we're all caught in a traffic jam, and one can get very self-righteous about someone butting in inappropriately, right? When one's actually going nowhere, right? But it can be a very strong sense of self, and so I think we should have the driving and tracting in traffic sutta. Maybe give that. Yeah, I once did a talk, which I published as the Parking Lot Sutta. That was a different situation, but could really do that, really take on, if we're going to make the practice our own, we have to do that. We have to take situations like driving, but, your own way of responding to it is marvelous. It's creative, and, what opens up generosity? In your case, having a sense of your children and just wanting to be supportive and shifting a way out of that. And, so anyone who wants to take on driving as a generosity practice, it's, you may have a practice session very soon.